There wasn't just one star out there, like she'd thought. There were four of them.
Quadruple star systems like this are quite rare, Thrawn said. I imagine navigating into the middle of one takes an extra toll on third sight.
Yes, I imagine it does, Phaleas said,
shifting hands to bring her other, colder one onto Ciri's forehead.
Why are we here? I mean, here.
Do you really want to know, caregiver?
Thrawn asked. Thalias's hand against Ciri's forehead suddenly went stiff.
Yes, sir, Thalias said. I really do.
Thrawn stepped around to Thalias's other side.
A refugee ship was found drifting in one of the Ascendancy's outlying systems, he said, his voice low.
Maybe Ciri wasn't supposed to hear this part?
We're following the likely vector the ship came from, in hope of identifying the people. A question, Lieutenant Commander Asmodee?
No, sir, the Lieutenant Commander said stiffly. But may I remind the Captain that there are certain areas that are to be kept...
Squinting past Thalias's hand, Ciri saw him pointing at her.
Within the Senior Officer Corps?
Your concern is noted, Lieutenant Commander, Thrawn said. However, at some point, Skywalker Ciri and Caregiver Thalias may be required to perform extraordinary tasks. It's important that the team knows what's at stake and is mentally prepared.
Ciri frowned. The team? No one had ever called her part of a team before. She'd never even thought of herself that way. She was the Skywalker, and her caregiver was her Momish, and that was all. Ciri guided the ship where it needed to go, and the caregiver made her meals and put her to bed at night. They weren't a team, were they?
Yes, sir, Asmodee said.
Ciri had heard enough unhappy officers to know what one sounded like. And this one definitely wasn't happy. But he didn't keep arguing.
It occurred to me that the refugees wouldn't want their enemy to know where they were going,
Thrawn continued.
I also read from the way the family units had been gathered together on the destroyed ship that the people had a close sense of comradeship. It seemed to me that such people would prefer to travel in groups. Or, if not a group, then at least with a companionship.
He paused, like he was expecting one of them to say something. Ciri looked at the four stars again, trying to think through her headache. And then, suddenly she had it.
I know,
she said, raising her hand.
The four stars. It's hard to get in here.
Yes, Thrawn said. Which means...
Ciri felt her shoulders hunch. She didn't have any idea what it meant.
Which means it's a perfect place for two ships to rendezvous,
Thalias said.
A place where any pursuers would hesitate to look. Do you think we'll find the other ship here?
Possibly.
Thrawn paused again, and Ciri had the feeling he was looking at her.
Skywalker Ciri, are you ready yet to return to your quarters?
The moment of excitement disappeared. Ciri wasn't part of the team anymore. Just someone there to move the ship around.
I think so,
she said with a sigh.
Let me help you,
Thalias said. She took Ciri's arm with one hand and undid the safety straps with the other.
Are you ready to stand up?
Yes,
Ciri said. She stood up, stopped as her head spun suddenly with vertigo. The universe settled down, and she nodded.
Okay,
she said, and walked around the chair. With Thalias still holding her arm, she went to the bridge hatchway. A moment later, they were walking down the corridor.
Are you hungry?
Thalias asked as they reached the door to their suite.
Or would you like a hot bath first?
A bath,
Ciri said.
Did you get overload spells like this?
Sometimes, Thalias said. Mostly when I was just starting out. But I had occasional ones right up to the end. Probably none of them as bad as this one, though.
She shook her head.
A 4-star system? The worst I ever had was a 3-star one. You're pretty amazing, Ciri.
Ciri wrinkled her nose.
Not really.
But the words felt good.
Captain Thrawn taking the time to talk to her had felt good, too. A hot bath would feel really good.
Well, you are, Thalias said. Let me get you settled, and I'll go draw your bath. Would you like your questis while you wait?
3 hours later, with Ciri bathed, fed, and finally asleep, Thalias returned to the bridge. To find that the Springhawk was no longer alone. Floating half a kilometer away from the viewport, its outer lights dark, was an alien ship. Zamacro was seated in the command chair, talking quietly with one of the other officers. He spotted Thalias, muttered a final comment, and as the other man headed for one of the consoles, he beckoned her over.
How is Ciri? He asked.
Sleeping, Thalias said, stopping beside his chair and gazing out at the alien ship.
The blocky shape made it look more like a freighter than a warship, she decided.
Where's Senior Captain Thrawn?
He went aboard with a survey team.
Zamacro shook his head.
Damnedest thing.
The ship?
The captain, Zamacro said. How did he know it would be here?
Thalias started to remind him of Thrawn's earlier analysis, remembered in time that Zamacro hadn't been there for that.
He has his methods,
she said instead.
Where was it?
Orbiting on the other side of the planet, Zamacro said. Wasn't until just after you left that it came into sight.
Thalias winced.
A dead ship. Probably with dead people aboard. Had Thrawn known or suspected when it would come out of hiding? Was that why he'd suddenly wanted her to take Ciri out of there and get her back to their suite? Because the helm officer was right. There were definitely some things that should be kept hidden from the Skywalkers.
So what's your story?
Zamacro asked.
Excuse me?
Thalias asked, frowning at him.
Please, Zamacro said scornfully. A former Skywalker, now working as a caregiver? Doesn't happen anymore. From what I've heard, once Skywalkers are done, they want to get as far away from that life as they can.
It wasn't that bad,
Thalias said,
only lying a little. Right, Zamacro said. And Myth family. And aboard Thrawn's ship. If you're really who you claim to be, that's a pretty heaping pile of coincidence.
The memory of her brief conversation with Syndic Thurfian flashed back to mind. Zamacro had no idea. A flicker of movement caught her eye. One of the Springhawk's shuttles, detaching from the ship and heading back.
If you have a point, please make it, she said. The captain's on his way back.
The Myth sent you to observe us, Zamacro said. Don't bother denying it. The officer who put you on the Springhawk told me that's how you first tried to get aboard. And also that a Myth syndic showed up at the last minute to give you a push.
Thalias kept her expression wooden.
And?
And I've seen the flaming mess observers can make aboard a warship, Zamacro said. They get in the way. They never know where to stand or which way to jump. And the introduce way more family politics than is healthy.
I'm not here to make trouble.
Doesn't matter, Simacro said. You just will.
He pointed at the ship floating in front of them.
Everyone over there is dead. Everyone on the ship that was attacked at Dioya is dead. Someone made them that way. Someone who may be brand new to us. And somewhere along the line, we may have to fight them.
His pointing finger shifted to Thalias.
I don't want to die because people were ignoring their boards and instead looking over their shoulders to see if the Myth Observer was watching them.
I think that's a sentiment we can all get behind,
Thalias said stiffly.
Let's make a deal. I'll do everything I can to not make a mess. You'll do everything you can to let me know when I'm making one anyway.
Don't say that if you don't mean it, Simacro warned. We do have a brig, you know.
Don't threaten something you can't follow through on, mid-captain, Thalias said. Don't forget, I'm the only one who can take care of your Skywalker.
Since when? Simacro scoffed. You mix up soup when she gets sick. You cuddle her when she's crying, and you make sure none of us dangerous warrior types scare her.
Trust me, there's a lot more to it than that,
Thalias said, pushing away her reflexive annoyance. If Simacro was trying to goad her into making enough trouble that he had an excuse to lock her up, he would have to try harder than that.
So what do we know about that ship? You said everyone was dead? How?
Simacro took a deep breath.
All we know so far is that the hyperdrive failed, which is what stranded them here. At least this batch wasn't murdered like the last group. Looks like they ran out of air.
His lips compressed briefly.
Not the worst way to die, for what it's worth.
It also means an intact ship and intact bodies, Thalias said.
Right, Simacro said. Hopefully, that'll give us what we need to backtrack them the rest of the way to their system.
Mid-Captain Simacro, this is the captain.
Thrawn's voice came over the bridge speaker.
Is the examination room prepared?
Simacro keyed the mic at his chair.
Yes, sir, he confirmed. We have four tables set up in Ready Room 2, and the medics and equipment are standing by.
Excellent,
Thrawn said.
Join me there, if you would.
On my way, sir.
He got three steps toward the bridge hatch before Thalias caught up with him.
Where do you think you're going?
Simacro asked, frowning at her.
Ready Room 2, Thalias said. Whatever the captain's found, it may impact on where we're going and how Ciri does her job. I need to know everything so that I can prepare her when the time comes.
Of course you do, Simacro said sourly. Fine. Lead the way.
Right,
Thalias said hesitantly.
You don't know where it is, do you?
Thalias huffed out a breath.
No.
Didn't think so, Simacro said. Follow me. And when we get there, stay out of the way. And don't make a mess.
The ready room was smaller than Thalias had expected. And with four tables, plus the medical team crammed in, the place was already crowded when she and Simacro arrived. The medics, naturally, quickly moved out of the way to give the Springhawk's first officer some space. Thalias, also naturally, had to work her way through them, avoiding elbows and glowers until she reached a corner that wasn't being used. She was still fine-tuning her position when Thrawn and the bodies arrived. There were four of them,
as Thrawn had implied. Three were of the same species. Medium height, with pronounced chest and hip bulges. Their skin a light pink, but with purple splotches around the eyes. All topped by feathery head crests. Their arms and legs were spindly, but looked well-muscled. They were dressed in clothing that was alien, but nevertheless with a style and detail that gave Thalias the impression of being someone's finery. The fourth body, in stark contrast, was tall and thin, with enlarged shoulders, elbows, wrists, knees, and ankles. Its skin was a pale gray, and across its temples was a crosshatch of green, red, and blue tattoo scars. It was dressed in a dark red, totally utilitarian jumpsuit.
"There's nothing like these in our records," Thrawn said, gesturing to the three pink bodies. "But the fourth, do you recognize it, Mid-Captain?"
"Yes," Simakro said, stepping close and peering at its stony face. "I don't know the species, but those temple scars mark him as a void guide."
He looked over at Thalias.
"They're one of the groups who hire themselves out as navigators for long-range travel through the chaos," he added.
"I know,"
Thalias said. She'd been aboard a warship once that had been escorting a diplomatic mission, and both ships had hired aliens from the Navigators Guild to help reinforce the carefully designed illusion that the Chiss had no navigators of their own. She and her caregiver had been kept out of sight in their suite, but she'd seen some vid views of the navigator at his job. She didn't remember that navigator looking anything like this dead void guide, but then the guild was made up of a lot of different groups and species.
"Actually, I'd have been surprised if you did know his species," Thrawn commented. "The Navigators Guild goes to great lengths not to identify the species or the systems of its members. At any rate, his presence is a stroke of luck."
"Why?"
Thalias asked.
"Because some of the bridge recordings survived the death of the crew and passengers," Thrawn said. "Naturally, those records are in the inhabitants' language."
"Which I assume we don't know?" Simakro asked.
"Correct," Thrawn said. "The analyzers might be able to do something with it, but without a linguistic basis to start from, they're unlikely to make much progress."
"But they also had to talk to their navigator,"
Thalias said, as she suddenly saw where Thrawn was going with this.
"And unless he could speak their language, they would have used a trade language."
"Exactly,"
Thrawn said, inclining his head toward her.
"And because the Void Guide's main operational area overlaps with ours, there's a reasonable chance it'll be a language we know."
"You said some of the recordings survived," Simakro said. "Any navigational records among them?"
"An excellent question, Mid-Captain,"
Thrawn said, his voice going grim.
"The answer is no. It appears the navigator was the last to die, and erase as many records as he could before the end. The only reason we have the audio recordings is that they were stored in a different location than the others, and he apparently missed them."
Thalias stared at the Void Guide body, a creepy feeling seeping through her.
"He didn't want anyone to know where they'd come from," she said. "He was working with their enemies."
"Or was working to keep their enemies from backtracking them,"
Simakro suggested.
"No,"
Thrawn said.
"If that was the situation, the captain would have deleted the records himself. The timestamp indicates that wasn't the case."
He turned back to Simakro.
"I'll be here for the next few hours observing the dissection. I want you to make two copies of the audio records. One for the analyzers, and one for my personal examination.
Yes, sir, Simacro said. With your permission, I'd like to also make an extra copy for myself. Senior Commander Carroll takes over the watch in half an hour, and I can begin listening to it while you watch things down here.
Excellent idea, Mid-Captain, Thrawn said. Thank you.
He looked at the Void Guide's body.
He went to some trouble to hide these people in their home from us. Let's see what we can learn of them, despite his efforts.
Thalias watched as Thrawn examined the bodies, noting the special attention he gave to their clothing and adornments. But once that part was over, and the medics stepped forward with their surgical equipment, she decided she'd had enough. The suite was dark and quiet as she slipped inside and locked the hatch behind her. She tiptoed across the day room, wondering if a hot bath would feel good, or if she was too tired to do anything except curl up in bed.
Thalias?
A tentative voice came from Ciri's room.
I'm here,
Thalias called back softly, changing direction toward the half-open hatchway.
Did I wake you?
No, I was already awake,
Ciri said.
Sorry, Thalias said. Are you hungry? Can I get you something to eat?
No.
Ciri hesitated.
I had a nightmare.
I'm so sorry,
she said again, opening the hatch all the way and stepping inside. In the faint glow from the luminous escape pod markers, she saw that Ciri was sitting up in bed, hunched over with her arms hugging one of her pillows to her chest. So much for that hot bath.
Do you want to talk about it?
No, I guess not,
Ciri said.
It's okay.
But she was still clutching that pillow.
Come on,
Thalias encouraged as she sat down at the end of the girl's bed.
Tell me yours, and I'll tell you one of mine.
You had nightmares too?
We all did,
Thalias said.
Just like the overload spells. I don't know if those things are a part of Third Sight itself, or if it's just all the pressure Skywalkers are under. But we all had them.
She patted Ciri's knee through the blanket.
Let me guess. You were lost? And everyone was mad at you?
Almost,
Ciri said.
I was lost, but they weren't mad. At least, they didn't say anything. But they kept looking at me. Just looking.
Yes, I had that one too,
Thalias said ruefully.
No one would talk to me, and they wouldn't listen. Sometimes they couldn't even hear me.
I remember thinking it was like being stuck in a big soap bubble,
Ciri said.
Thalias smiled.
That part's from your bath.
What?
Your bath,
Thalias repeated.
The soothement bubbles? Your brain picked up on that memory and slapped it into your dream.
Really? Brains do things like that?
All the time,
Thalias said.
Yours took the soothement bubbles, added in your fears of getting lost, sprinkled on some of the feeling you get on the bridge that none of the grown-ups are paying any attention to you, then baked all of it inside a dream. Pop it from the oven, and there's your nightmare.
Oh.
Ciri pondered that a moment.
Doesn't sound so scary that way.
Nope,
Thalias agreed.
Almost silly, in fact, once the lights are back on. Doesn't mean it's not terrifying when you're in the middle of it, but it helps make it better when you can figure out the pieces afterward. It's just your brain and your fears messing with you.
Okay.
Ciri hugged the pillow a little tighter.
Thalias, did you ever get lost?
Thalias hesitated. How should she answer that?
Not when I was your age, she said. But I'll bet you never got lost either.
But you got lost later?
I sort of got lost once or twice, Phileas admitted. But that was when they already knew my third sight was fading, and they were running me through tests inside the Ascendancy. They do that on purpose, because they know that if the Skywalker loses the track, it won't be dangerous to the ship.
And then you were done?
Ciri murmured. And I thought my life was over. Phileas smiled. But as you see, it wasn't. Yours won't be either.
But if I get us lost...
You won't, Phileas said firmly.
What if I do?
You won't, Phileas said. Trust me, and trust yourself.
I don't think I can.
You have to, Phileas said. Uncertainty can be the most difficult and frightening of mental states. If you're always wondering which way to go, you might freeze up and not go anywhere. If you're afraid you can't do something, you might not even try.
Ciri shook her head.
I don't know.
Well, you don't have to know anything tonight, Phileas said. All you have to do is lie down and try to get back to sleep. You sure I can't get you something to eat?
No, that's okay,
Ciri said.
She looked down at the pillow in her arms, then shifted it around behind her.
Maybe I'll draw for a while,
she added, settling herself against the pillow and snagging her questus from the bedside table.
Sounds good, Phileas said. Do you want me to come sit with you?
No, that's okay,
Ciri said.
Thanks.
You're welcome, Phileas said, standing up and backing toward the hatchway. I'll leave the door open. If you need anything, just call, okay? And try to sleep.
I will,
Ciri said.
Good night, Phileas.
Good night, Ciri.
Phileas waited another hour, just in case Ciri changed her mind and decided she needed something. By the time she finally turned off her light and settled into bed, Ciri's own room light was out, and the girl was once again fast asleep. And of course, because Phileas had talked about them, her own Skywalker nightmares chose that night to come back.
This just came in, Admiral,
Wootra-O said, handing over Questus.
Not entirely sure what it means.
Aralani ran her eyes over the message.
Rendezvous with me at the following coordinates as soon as possible. Bring only the Vigilant. Do not hire a navigator.
I checked the coordinates,
Wootra-O continued.
It's pretty far out. Without a navigator, it'll take 4 or 5 days to get there.
Not exactly Thrawn's usual definition of as soon as possible,
Aralani agreed.
All right.
I assume you signaled Naporar and asked if they could assign us a temporary Skywalker?
Wootra-O nodded.
I did. And...
No, let me guess, Aralani said. You got shunted around to at least 3 different desks until you finally reached someone who said it would be a month before anyone was free.
Not exactly,
Wootra-O said, her voice odd.
I got sent directly to Supreme General Barkeef.
She lifted a finger for emphasis.
Not the General's office. The General.
Barkeef took your call personally.
I was rather shocked too,
Wootra-O said.
Especially when he said a Skywalker would be waiting for us when we reached Naporar.
Well, that's fun for the archives,
Aralani said, frowning.
No fuss or anything?
Not about the Skywalker,
Wootra-O said.
But there was one other odd thing. When we see Thrawn, we're supposed to ask about his Skywalker's caregiver. There's apparently some confusion as to who she is and how she got the job.
Really? Aralani said, looking at the Questus note again. So whatever Thrawn was doing was important enough that one of the top people on the Council was taking a personal interest, while at the same time, there was something going on under the surface involving his Skywalker and her caregiver. Naturally, Thrawn would be oblivious to both currents.
Very well, she said. Set course for Naparar. Best speed we've got.
Yes, ma'am,
Utero said.
And once we're on the way,
Aralani added, handing back the Questus,
have the weapons crews start full service scans on their equipment.
You think there'll be combat at the other end of this trip?
Thrawn's there,
Aralani reminded her.
So yes, I'd say that's pretty much guaranteed.
Chapter 5. The Springhawk was waiting precisely where Thrawn had said he would be. A quick shuttle ride across, and within an hour of arriving in the system, Aralani and Wutra'o were sitting in the briefing room with Thrawn and Simakro, reading through Thrawn's data and proposal. Aralani took her time looking through the material. She read it a second time, as she always did such things. Then, just to make sure it really said what she thought it said, she read it a third time. By the time she lifted her eyes from the Questus, she saw that Wutra'o and Simakro had made it through as well. The two officers were gazing at the sections of the table in front of them, their expressions a mixture of surprise, disbelief, and apprehension. She shifted her gaze to the end of the table. Thrawn was waiting patiently, trying to hide his own anxiety.
Well, she said, setting down her Questus. It's inventive, I'll give it that.
Some of Thrawn's anxiety faded away. Apparently, a lot of his concern had been centered on how she would react.
Thank you, he said. With all due respect, Senior Captain, I'm not sure that was a compliment,
Simakro spoke up.
The plan may be inventive, but I don't think it's physically possible.
Actually, Mid-Captain, I've seen it done,
Aralani said.
Back at the Academy, Captain Thrawn pulled off this same maneuver.
She raised her eyebrows.
On the other hand, that was a patrol ship. This time you're talking about a heavy cruiser. Big difference.
Not as big as it might seem,
Thrawn said.
True, the Springhawk's mass is greater, but its thrusters and maneuvering jets are correspondingly more powerful. With proper care and preparation, I believe it can be done.
And you're sure this is the right system?
The indications are there,
Thrawn said.
I won't know for certain until I've examined the mining station.
Aralani pursed her lips and picked up her Questus again. It certainly wasn't going to be easy. The place Thrawn proposed to infiltrate was what was colloquially known as a box system. Unusually strong electromagnetic fluxes wrapped around the outer edges, interacting with solar wind, to create even more obstruction to hyperspace travel than usual. Unless a ship was willing to come out of hyperspace outside the cometary belt and spend days or weeks traveling through space normal to the inner system, there were only a dozen reasonably safe inward pathways. Even more intimidating was the fact that some cataclysm millennia ago had seeded the inner system and much of the outer system with large meteors, making the entire area a sort of miniature version of the chaos itself. Taking those additional navigational hazards into account, the number of safe lanes to the inhabited planet dropped to exactly 3. 3 routes to one single isolated planet, unknown to the Ascendancy, and apparently unconnected with any known species in the area.
a somewhat larger selection of pathways to the outer asteroid belt, which consisted of several tightly packed clusters and a number of possibly abandoned mining space stations. But while the mining stations might be abandoned, the rest of the system was active enough. Thrawn's brief reconnaissance had picked up a fair amount of travel within the system, mostly between the planet and a handful of colony or manufacturing stations orbiting it. Unfortunately, the Springhawk had been too far out to tell whether or not those ships were similar to the destroyed refugee ships whose records Thrawn had now shared with her and Wootro. And just to add spice to the whole thing, all three of the entry routes were being patrolled by small warships of a completely different design.
"So you think this is the system the refugee ships came from?" she said, looking up at Thrawn again. "You further think they're under blockade by these other ships?"
"Less a blockade than an interdiction," Thrawn said. "You can see the patrol ship's configuration is mainly designed to control access to the main planet. The asteroid stations aren't as heavily guarded, and are therefore more accessible."
"But they are still guarded," Wootro pointed out. "And I'm only counting three good paths in and out of the system."
"Only if you want the planet," Thrawn said. "If you want the asteroid station I've indicated, there are several other workable vectors."
"At least until the blockaders get a few more ships," Orellani said.
"Indeed," Thrawn agreed. "It therefore seems to me that if we want to do this, we have to do it soon."
"How long did you sit out on the edge observing them?" Orellani asked.
"Only 3 days, Simacro said. "A full 3 days," Thrawn corrected. "Long enough for me to analyze their patrol pattern and learn how to penetrate it."
"Again, unless they've gotten more ships in the past 15 hours, Orellani said.
Thrawn's lip twitched.
"Yes."
For a few moments, the conference room was quiet. Orellani gazed at her questis, pretending to study it, weighing the options. For anyone else she knew, 3 days wouldn't be nearly enough to analyze an alien patrol pattern, let alone figure out a way through it. But for Thrawn, 3 days probably really was enough, Simacro's doubts notwithstanding. Orellani couldn't have come up with a plan herself this quickly, but she could see that Thrawn's had a good chance of working. On the other hand, this was hardly going to be a sleepwalk. Thrawn's proposed course should get them in well ahead of any pursuit from the handful of patrol ships watching the outer system. But if the blockade's commander detached some of his closer-in planetary forces, he might catch the two Chiss ships in a pincer.
"What about exit strategy?" she asked. "We'll need one immediately, and you'll need one eventually."
"There, we have two interesting options," Thrawn said. As if, Orellani thought wryly, this whole thing didn't come under the heading of interesting. "The typical box system is bounded, for the most part, by external flux patterns interacting with solar wind. These two points," he tapped his questis, "mark the outer system's two gas giant planets."
Orellani smiled tightly as she saw it.
"Planets which carve out small holes in the solar wind as they travel along their orbits. Holes you can pop in and out of without confusing your hyperdrive or your Skywalker,"
Wootro said.
"Ha! Hard to hit from the outside, though, unless you've got really good planetary data. But not as difficult going from the inside," Orellani said, "since you know right where the planets and gaps are."
She looked at Thrawn with sudden realization.
"That's how the refugee ships got out past the patrols, isn't it?"
"That's my assumption," Thrawn said.
"And now, of course, we've also got the planetary data we need,"
Wootro added.
"So we go in through shadow number one and exit through shadow number two?"
"Exactly," Thrawn said. and the Springhawk can subsequently leave through either. They're close enough together for your purposes, but far enough apart that the blockaders won't be able to sufficiently guard both, if they even wish to do so.
Unless, as we all keep saying, they found more ships,
Wutra-O pointed out. Thrawn nodded.
Yes.
Okay, I'm confused,
Wutra-O said, frowning at her questus.
You don't blockade a place unless you want to take it over. I'm sure it's a great place to live, but why would anyone else want it?
Box systems have some advantages, Simacro said. As we've already noted, they're easy to defend and don't get much random traffic passing through. As such, they're ideal as supply depots, staging areas, and maintenance facilities.
But easy to defend also means easy to bottle up,
Wutra-O pointed out.
Our unknown opponents do display a certain degree of arrogance, Thrawn said. Something we'll be able to use against them when the time comes.
He looked at Ar'alani.
If the time comes, he amended.
Admiral?
Ar'alani pursed her lips.
It was a gamble, but then so was all warfare.
All right. Let's do it, she said. Pick your spot, and we'll rendezvous there.
She lifted a finger.
Two things first. Before we head out, I want your Skywalker and her caregiver moved to the Vigilant. You're going into danger, and I want them safe. You can do a jump-by-jump to get out, and then rendezvous with us to get them back.
I agree that Skywalker Ciri should join you, Thrawn said. But I'll need Thalias to remain with me.
Ar'alani frowned.
Why?
The alien clothing and the positioning of the bodies suggest the males hold their females in high esteem,
Thrawn explained.
If I have a female with me...
A moment, Senior Captain,
Wutra-O put in, frowning.
What do you mean, from their clothing and body positions?
Thrawn shook his head.
I wish I could explain it, Senior Captain, he said. I can see it. I can understand it. But I can't really put it into words. The point is that if I have a woman with me, I believe any guards we encounter will be less likely to attack before listening to our explanations.
I thought you said the mining stations were deserted.
I believe they were, Thrawn said. But as Admiral Ar'alani pointed out, it's been 15 hours since our last observation. It's mostly a precaution.
And you really think a woman can talk them down?
Wutra-O persisted.
How? Let's skip the how for a moment and focus on the who,
Ar'alani said. She could sympathize with Wutra-O. She'd certainly had her share of trust-me moments with Thrawn. But she also knew there was a point at which he simply couldn't put his analysis into words.
Thalias is a civilian, which limits what you can order her to do.
I believe she'll be willing to volunteer.
That's not the point, Ar'alani said. If you want a woman to accompany you, there are plenty of female officers to choose from.
Thrawn shook his head.
I need the Springhawk to be at full combat capability in case something goes wrong. That means every officer and warrior at their posts.
Ar'alani shifted her attention to Simacro.
Meet Captain, she invited.
Unfortunately, Senior Captain Thrawn is correct, Simacro said reluctantly. We're not exactly short-handed, but we have more than our fair share of inexperienced personnel aboard. If Thalias is willing, she's probably the one who should go.
Ar'alani looked back at Thrawn.
You really think you can prove this is where the refugees came from if you get aboard that station? Even if there are no people or bodies or anything else aboard?
Absolutely, Thrawn said. There'll be designs and patterns that will quickly settle the question.
At which point, what? Arlani had no idea what B'Keefe's plans were once Thrawn located the origin of the destroyed ship. But figuring that out was his job, not Arlani's. Her job was to work with Thrawn to get the proof B'Keefe needed.
All right, she said. But only if Thalias is willing. If not, she stays with the Vigilant and you choose someone else.
Understood, Thrawn said. Whenever you're ready, Admiral. I have the coordinates for our rendezvous prepared.
The Springhawk was ready. Or at least it was as ready as Simacro could make it. Simacro himself? Not so much. He could appreciate that the Council thought this mission was important. He could also appreciate that Thrawn's plan was probably their best chance of slipping into the alien system and gaining that data without having to engage either the inhabitants or the ship's riding herd on them. That last point was crucial. Ascendancy policy was to do whatever was necessary to avoid preemptive combat against potential adversaries. An incursion into someone else's territory, even just to gather data, drifted perilously close to the line. The faster Arlani could get the Vigilant in and out, the less chance either Chiss ship would need to fire its weapons.
Vigilant, Thrawn called.
Be ready,
Arlani's voice came back.
Vector locked. Maneuvering jets charged. Let me know when to go.
One moment,
Thrawn said, leaning forward a bit in his command chair as he gazed at the tactical display.
I need Blockade 4 to move a little farther in its orbit. There. Stand by countdown. 3, 2, 1.
There was the subtle shift in the deck vibrations as the Springhawk moved forward. Simacro peered up through the bridge canopy, confirming that the Vigilant was also in motion and staying in perfect sync with the smaller cruiser. In perfect sync, and way too close for comfort. Simacro scowled. In theory, the plan was simple. The Springhawk would fly alongside the Vigilant, staying close to its hull and hiding in the bigger ship's sensor shadow, until they reached the point where the cruiser would slip away and duck inside one of the asteroid clusters. The Springhawk would go dark, hopefully undetected, and let the Vigilant lead away any pursuit. In practice, the whole thing was a disaster crouched to spring. Thrawn had opted not to use cables to connect the ships, pointing out that a small error in either ship's vector would create a visible ripple that an alert sensor operator might spot. Tractor beams were impractical for the same reason, plus the added disadvantage of generating a possibly detectable energy signature. Connecting the two ships with maglocks, allowing the larger ship to simply carry the smaller one, would show a blatant mass thrust discrepancy. So instead, Thrawn was going to attempt the kind of close-in flying normally associated with air shows. The problem being that he was attempting it with a cruiser and a night dragon instead of the smaller and far more maneuverable missile boats.
Pitch shift on one, Thrawn called. Stand by countdown. 3, 2, 1. Simacro tensed, waiting for the inevitable collision.
To his relief, and mild surprise, the inevitable didn't happen. Both bows tilted upward at precisely the same time, and to precisely the same angle, and the ships continued on.
Blockades 1 and 2 are reacting,
came a voice from someone on the Vigilant.
Increasing speed and moving on to intercept vectors. Time to intercept,
Arlani asked.
Projected intercept 3 minutes after Springhawk disengages. Thrawn?
Arlani asked. Thrawn didn't answer. Simacro looked over at the command station to see his commander working his Questus.
I suggest a 2% increase in speed, Admiral, he said.
2% confirmed,
Arulani said.
Course changes?
The next two can run as scheduled, Thrawn said. I'll need to recompute the others.
Understood,
Arulani said.
Speed increase and starboard turn ready.
Acknowledged, Thrawn said. Stand ready, speed increase. 3, 2, 1.
There was a slight sensation, as much imagined as felt, as the Springhawk increased its speed.
Stand ready, starboard turn,
Thrawn continued, as the two ships settled into their new vectors.
3, 2, 1.
This turn was larger than the earlier pitch maneuver, shifting them a full 7 degrees. Once again, the two ships stayed in perfect formation.
Get busy on those revisions,
Arulani warned.
Support side change is scheduled for 3 minutes from now.
Acknowledged,
Thrawn said, his fingers skipping over his questus.
They'll be ready when we need them.
Zamacro peered out through the canopy, feeling sweat gathering beneath his tunic collar. The more course changes they made, the higher the odds that one of the ships would make a mistake, and the whole illusion would pop like a bubble. But Thrawn had insisted on piling complexity onto their incursion, arguing that a steady straight-in vector might raise suspicions of a second intruder, while multiple course changes should allay any such concerns. The other option being the conclusion that whoever was in charge of the mission was crazy. That was certainly the one Zamacro himself was going with at the moment. The minutes ticked by. One by one, the course shifts were recalculated and factored in. Zamacro watched the tactical as the two ships continued inward, listening to the sensor officer's running commentary on the status of the pursuing blockade ships. A third had joined the party now, angling in from a direction that would bring it into clear view of the Springhawk nearly a minute before the cruiser was scheduled to break off. Thrawn and Arulani discussed the situation, and once again the Chiss ships increased their speed a few percent. Zamacro continued to watch and listen, keeping a close eye on the Springhawk's weapon and defense monitors, just in case Thrawn's plan degenerated into a battle. And then, suddenly, they were there.
Stand ready to break off, Thrawn said. Admiral?
Standing ready,
Arulani said.
Blockades 1 and 2, now 4.5 minutes from intercept. Blockade 3, 90 seconds from visual. We'll continue on for 3 minutes, then head for Shadow 2 and hyperspace. That should give you enough time to settle in.
Acknowledged, Thrawn said. We can make do with 2 minutes if you need to break early.
I'll keep that in mind,
Arulani said.
We'll wait for you at the rendezvous. Good luck.
Helm, Thrawn called.
Standing ready, sir,
Asmorty confirmed.
Prepare to veer off, Thrawn said. Stand ready. 3, 2, 1.
With multiple puffs of compressed gas, the Springhawk angled to port side, moving away from the Vigilant on a vector that would take it across the edge of the nearest asteroid cluster. Zamacro held his breath, focusing his attention on the tactical display. If the blockade ship spotted them, the charade would be over. He twitched reflexively as the Vigilant, now pulled ahead of them, put on a sudden burst of speed, shifting its angle as if Arulani was trying one last maneuver to try to get to the planet in the distance before her pursuers reached combat range. If she was able to keep the blockaders' attention on her for a few more seconds, they might pull this off. The slowly wobbling asteroid that was their goal loomed ahead of them. With another blast of cold gas, the Springhawk braked to a halt beside the asteroid. Another carefully tuned pulse, and the cruiser had matched itself to the asteroid's slow spin. Zamacro looked at the tactical, noting that the blockade ships were still fully invested with chasing down the Vigilant.
"Full stealth mode," Thrawn ordered.
All around them, the bridge displays and monitor boards winked red and then went dark.
"We appear to have arrived undetected," Thrawn added calmly.
Simacro took a deep breath, making one more visual sweep to make sure all non-essential systems had been locked down.
"So it would appear," he said, matching his commander's tone. "How long do we wait?"
Thrawn looked past him at the stars, now tracking slowly across the sky.
"We need to allow the Vigilant to escape, and the blockade ships to return to their picket positions. A few hours, no more."
Simacro nodded, and then it would be time for Thrawn to slip over to the abandoned mining station floating halfway across the asteroid cluster, where they would find out if this whole gamble had been worth the effort. The Vigilant Skywalker was named Abeg, and she was only 8. But she had some interesting moldable play figures and some really nice colored graph markers. And she had a lot of building snaps. Way more than Chiri had. They were starting to play with them when Abeg's Momish told them to stop.
"It's reading time, girls," the woman said. "Put away the snaps and get your questesses. Come, come, come. Toys away, questesses out."
"Do we have to?"
Abeg asked in a whiny voice.
"We want to play."
Chiri made a face. A whiner. Great. She hated being around whiners. Still, Abeg had a point.
"We just did some trips,"
Chiri spoke up.
"We're supposed to get some rest now."
"Ah, fishes,"
the Momish said, wiggling her fingers like she was throwing away Chiri's words.
"You did 2 trips, maybe 2 hours each. I've seen Skywalkers do 10 hours at a stretch and come up smiling and ready for more."
"But..."
Abeg started.
"Besides, reading is resting," the Momish said. "Come on, come on, questesses and chairs, now!"
Chiri looked at Abeg. If they both insisted, maybe they could talk themselves into at least another few minutes. Chiri had started a really neat design with her snaps and wanted to finish it before she forgot where all the pieces were supposed to go. But Abeg just sighed and put down her own snaps. She stood up tiredly and went to one of the chairs.
"Chiri," the Momish said. "You too."
Chiri looked at her snaps. This woman wasn't Chiri's own Momish. Maybe she wasn't allowed to tell another Momish's Skywalker what she had to do. But Chiri had had a couple of Momishes like her. Arguing with them hadn't usually gotten her anywhere. Besides, Abeg was looking at Chiri with pleading in her eyes. Chiri might get away with defying the Momish, only to have that annoyance come back to dump on the little girl after Chiri was gone. She'd had a couple of Momishes like that, too. "Nothing to do but go along with it." Making a face, she went over to where she'd put her things, dug her questis out of her pack, and climbed onto the chair next to Abeg's. She would never admit it to Thalias or anyone else, but she hated reading.
"There you go,"
the Momish said. Now that she'd gotten her way, she sounded a little more cheerful. They always did.
"Reading is very important, you know. The more you practice, the better you get."
"It's not study time,"
Abeg said.
"We don't have to study, do we?"
"It's study time if I say it's study time,"
the Momish said sternly.
"Which you know perfectly well. When our ship is on the journey, we never know when you'll be called to the bridge. So we have to study when we have the chance."
She looked at Chiri,
But since we have a guest, and her classes won't be the same as yours, no, we're not doing studies. But you still have to read,
she added, as Abeg started to say something.
Whatever you want, half an hour. And then you can play until dinner time.
There was a ping from the hatch.
Enter,
the Momish called. The hatch slid open, and Admiral Aralani stepped into the suite.
Everyone all right?
She asked.
Do you need Abeg?
The Momish asked.
No, it's all right,
Aralani said, holding up a hand and smiling at Abeg as the little girl put down her questis.
I expect the Vigilant to stay where we are for the rest of the night. If we have to go anywhere, we can do a short jump by jump. So no, you girls can relax.
She shifted her eyes to Ciri.
I mostly came by to tell you, Ciri, that Thrawn and the Springhawk have made it to the asteroid, where they'll be hiding for the next few hours. They're safe, and it doesn't look like anyone saw them.
Okay,
Ciri said. She still wasn't fully clear on what all the fancy flying had been about, but she was glad the Springhawk was safe.
Thelius is with him, right?
Yes, she is,
Aralani said, her voice sounding a little strange.
But I'm afraid you'll have to sleep here tonight. I'll have an extra bed brought in for you.
She can sleep in my bed,
Abeg said, sitting straight up in her chair.
It's big enough.
Ciri cringed. She'd never, ever had to share a bed. And with an 8-year-old?
I'd rather have my own,
she said. She looked at Abeg's suddenly disappointed expression.
I kick a lot when I sleep, she added.
Can you put the bed in my room?
Abeg asked.
I...
She stopped and looked over at the Momish.
I sometimes get scared,
she finished in a little voice. Ciri winced, feeling guilty. After talking with Thelius about nightmares...
That would work,
she said.
Sure, we can take some figures with us and play before we go to sleep.
Caregiver? Aralani asked. If it's all right with Abeg, it's fine with me.
The woman actually smiled.
I remember having sleepovers when I was their age. Pretty sure I can whip up a few snacks for them, and we'll make it an event.
Sounds reasonable,
Aralani said. But, she raised a warning finger.
When your caregiver says it's time for lights out, girls, it's time for lights out. If we need you, we don't want you so tired you'll accidentally steer us into a supernova.
Yes, ma'am. We will,
Abeg promised, her earlier excitement starting to bubble up again.
Anything else we can do for you, Admiral?
The Momish asked.
No, Aralani said. I just wanted to let you all know what was happening. Have a good evening.
She gave both girls a pretend frown.
And get some sleep.
The frown disappeared. She smiled again and left.
This is going to be fun,
Abeg said, bouncing a little on her chair.
It'll be fun, right?
Sure,
Ciri said.
We'll make sure of it,
the Momish promised.
Right now, it's still reading time. Half an hour, and the sooner you start, the sooner you'll be done.
You want to read a story about tree people?
Abeg asked, holding her questis toward Ciri.
There are lots of good pictures.
Ciri wrinkled her nose. A picture book? She might not like to read, but she was way past picture books.
That's okay,
she told the younger girl.
I've got something else I'm supposed to read.
She said we didn't have to study.
This isn't studies,
Ciri assured her.
Go on, get busy. I want to get back to those snaps.
Okay.
Settling herself cross-legged in her chair, Abeg propped her questis on her knee
and started to read. Chiri picked up her questus, her eyes straying over to the low table where Abeg's colored graph markers were scattered. Her last momish had told her graph markers got all over everything and wouldn't let her have them. But that was her last momish. Maybe Thalias would let her get some. She'd ask her once they were back on the Springhawk. If she could get some graph markers and some paper, she could do some real artwork. Looking back at the questus, she punched up the list. Along with the familiar storybooks, some of which she'd read more than once, she spotted a longer one. Some stories about Mithron Yerodo. She frowned. She'd completely forgotten about the file Thalias had sent her. It was pretty long, and there were bound to be big, complicated words. But with Thrawn and Thalias and the Springhawk in danger, maybe reading some of it would help her feel better. Thalias had seemed to think it would anyway. And just because she started, it didn't mean she had to read the whole thing. Settling herself comfortably in the corner of her chair, she braced herself and opened to the first page. Memories 4. General Bakif had told Ziara that she had good instincts, but she quickly learned that good, unfortunately, didn't mean perfect. The first such lesson came very quickly. The weekend after Thrawn was acquitted, he called to invite her out, to help him celebrate and as a thank you for her help. From the enthusiastic way he talked about the evening, she'd envisioned a night of music and food, perhaps a gymnastic or musical performance, and certainly a modicum of drink. What she got instead, she looked around her at the quiet patrons and the somber colors, at the neatly arranged hangings, pictures, sculptures, and drapings. "An art gallery," she said, her voice flat. "You brought me to an art gallery?" "Of course," he said, giving her a puzzled look. "Where did you think we were going?"
"You said there would be insight, drama, and the excitement of discovery," she reminded him.
"There is." He pointed down a hallway. "The history of the Ascendancy is in these rooms. Some of the pieces dating back to the Chiss participation in the wars between the Galactic Republic and the Sith Empire."
"I seem to remember that era not being a particularly glowing time for the Ascendancy."
"Agreed," Thrawn said. "But look at how our tactics and strategies have changed since then."
Ziara frowned.
"Excuse me?"
"Our tactics and strategies," Thrawn repeated, frowning back.
"Yes, I heard you," Ziara said. "Why are we talking tactics in an art gallery?"
"Because the one is reflected in the other," Thrawn said. "Art mirrors the soul from which tactics arise. One can see in artwork the strengths and weaknesses of those who created it. In fact, if one has a sufficient variety of art to study, one can extend and extrapolate to the strengths, weaknesses, and tactics of entire cultures."
Abruptly, Ziara realized her mouth was hanging open.
"That's very interesting," she managed.
Maybe, she thought belatedly, she shouldn't have worked so hard to get him off the hook after all.
"You don't believe me," Thrawn said.
"Fine. There are alien artworks two chambers over. You pick whichever culture you want, and I'll show you how to read their tactics."
Ziara had never been in an alien art wing, in this gallery or any other. The closest she'd ever come to non-Chiss artifacts, in fact, was the twisted chunk of debris from a Patatis warship that was displayed at the Arisi family homestead on Chila.
"Where did all this come from?"
she asked,
looking at the various flats and sculptures as Thrawn led the way through the entry arch into the hall.
Most were purchased by various merchants and traders and subsequently donated to the gallery, Thrawn told her. Some are from species we still have contact with, but the majority are from aliens we encountered during the Sith Wars, before the retreat back to our own borders. Here we go.
He stopped in front of a clear-sided case containing translucent bottles and plates.
Scofty formal tableware from a governmental regime 100 years ago.
Thrawn identified them.
What do you see?
Ciara shrugged.
It's pretty enough. Especially those internal color swirls.
How about durability?
Thrawn asked. Does it seem sturdy? Ciara looked closer. Now that he mentioned it.
Unless that material is a lot stronger than it looks, not at all.
Exactly, Thrawn said.
The Scofty change leaders and governments frequently, often under violence or the threat of violence. Since each new leader typically reorganizes the prefecture's palace, all the way down to the decor and the tableware, the artisans see no point in making anything for them that will last longer than a year. Indeed, since the new master often takes pleasure in publicly destroying the personal items of his or her predecessor, there's a strong incentive to deliberately make everything fragile.
Really?
Ciara eyed him suspiciously.
Is that really true? Or are you just guessing?
We've been in marginal contact with them for the past 20 years,
Thrawn said.
And our records support that conclusion. But I made that assessment from the gallery's artifacts before I looked up the history.
Ciara looked at the items another moment.
Okay, what's next?
Thrawn looked around the room.
This is an interesting one, he said, pointing toward another display case nearby. They called themselves the Brodihi.
Called? Past tense?
Ciara asked as they walked over to it.
They're all dead?
We don't actually know, Thrawn said.
These artifacts were recovered from the wreckage of a downed ship over 300 years ago. We still don't know who they were, where they came from, or whether they still exist.
Ciara nodded as she did a quick scan of the case's contents. More dinnerware, plates, plus elongated flatware, all decorated with angled, rainbow-colored stripes, plus a few tools. In the back of the case was a picture of an alien with a long snout and a pair of horns jutting from the top of its head, along with a short description of the creatures and the circumstances of the discovery.
So, what can you tell me about them?
You'll note the angled colored bars on the flatware,
Thrawn said.
In order for the lines to match, the knives, forks, and spoons must be angled toward the center of the table, and then back toward the edge.
Ciara nodded.
Like a pair of opening bird wings.
Or,
Thrawn prompted. Ciara frowned and took another look at the alien picture.
Or, like the shape of their horns.
That was my conclusion as well, Thrawn agreed. Also note that while the spoons and forks would point toward the center of the table, the knives must be pointed backward, toward the edge for the color bars to line up. What does that tell you?
Ciara studied the display, trying to visualize one of the creatures sitting where she and Thrawn were standing, waiting for food to be put on his plate.
The knives are much better weapons than the spoons and forks, she said slowly. Positioning the points toward you suggests that you have no animosity or designs against the others at the table.
Very good,
Thrawn said.
Now, add to that the fact that if you turn the knives over, the pattern suggests that they point toward the center, like the other flatware, instead of toward the table's edge. What does that suggest?
Ziara smiled. The structure of their own Chiss culture gave the answer to that one.
That there's a social or political hierarchy involved, she said. Depending on your rank relative to the others at the table, you turn your knife inward or outward.
Again, that was my conclusion as well, Thrawn said. One final thing.